to Life, Love, and Money. I am Diane Seichel. All of us have either been through or know someone going through a divorce. And so today, our special guest is attorney Pamela Donison. Pamela Donison's practice focuses on ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution. Our call today will focus on collaborative and cooperative divorce. Well, Pamela Donison, I found out about Pamela through her ad that I saw in one of the local magazines here in Phoenix, Arizona. And I also heard of collaborative divorce when I was down visiting in San Diego, but I had never heard of it outside of a little bit here and there. And I really believe that there's a way to do divorce that's environmentally friendly. You're either going to make the trip either way, so the question is, are you going to go kicking and screaming, or are you going in dignity, generosity, and peace? And with that, I'd like to introduce Pamela Donison.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. How about yourself?
It's a great day.
Perfect. Great. Well, Pamela, can you tell us the difference between a traditional, a collaborative or cooperative, and a do-it-yourself divorce?
I sure can. Those are a lot of different things. So let me start off with saying, first of all, thank you for having me on your show, and thank you to all of your listeners. And the basis of our legal system for family law is derived from civil litigation. And civil litigation means, for example, a contract dispute, someone ran into you and you know, had an accident in your car. Something like that is a civil dispute. And so we've derived our family law statutes, rules, and procedures from that civil dispute model. And unfortunately, it doesn't really take into account the realities of life, which are that this is a family situation, and there are children, and there are houses, and all sorts of things that don't ordinarily occur in a civil litigation context. So while the court has tried to adapt the rules and statutes for families, it doesn't fit real well. It's trying to stick a square peg into a round hole in most instances. So the civil litigation model and the model that we follow in family court is that there's a petitioner, there's a respondent, there are allegations, there are sometimes motions back and forth for different things. For example, a motion for temporary orders would mean that one person wants some orders in place between now and the time that a decree of dissolution is entered. So it really follows that civil litigation model and doesn't take into account the realities of the parties. Where we see that most impact people is in determinations of parenting time, child custody sometimes, and certainly in division of assets and liabilities. And when you're going through a divorce, if you're going to go through that ordinary track of filing a petition and filing a response and so on, what sometimes happens, and I think most often happens, is that people want results right away. But the court system is overloaded, frankly, and certainly now with budget cuts and personnel cuts, the courts are more overloaded than ever. And so people may believe that they want their day in court, but what they don't realize is that their day in court may be 6, 9, or even 12 months away. And that's really difficult. It's difficult to live in limbo for that period of time. Also, in the usual model, the litigated model of a divorce, the financial impact on the family is huge. I have a little sign in my office that a friend gave me that says, "Love is grand, divorce is 100 grand." And it's sort of, yeah, it's sort of funny, but the sad part is it's sort of true. It's very unusual, I think, if you're going to go through an ordinary course of a litigated divorce, very unusual that you can get by with less than $25,000 per person for that privilege. And most divorces, if there's even a smattering of conflict, the attorneys are going to bill you for the privilege of having the conflict and for them managing your conflict for you. So really, in a litigated divorce, you're paying other people to manage your own conflict and paying other people to manage the division of your assets and liabilities. And while that's perfectly acceptable in our society, it's very expensive. And the expense in general, I would say, and I did a little bit of research on this, the average cost of a divorce in the United States is $30,000 per person. And that's pretty expensive when you think about what you could buy for $60,000.
Yeah, I remember when we were talking, you said you can either put your kids through college or mine.
Right, right. And, you know, again, it's sort of, it's an off-the-cuff sort of a remark. You can put your kids through college or you can put my kid through college. But, you know, my daughter now has a master's degree, so I don't know if he's going to be going for that doctorate or not. So, you know, that's certainly something for people to consider is the financial cost of a litigated divorce. But far more devastating, in my opinion, is the emotional cost to the family. You can be divorced all day, but you're going to be a family. If you have children, you're going to be a family for the rest of your lives. So the emotional cost that is extracted in a litigated divorce, very often, I would say most often, is completely devastating. And you never recover from it. The family dynamic never recovers from it. And the people that benefit from that are, of course, the attorneys and the judges and everyone else in the court system who gets to participate in your divorce. The people who suffer the most are the children, and they're the ones that usually have no voice in the room. And that, to me, is a travesty. It's an injustice all the way around. If you move down the spectrum from, you know, we're on the far right side here from a litigated divorce, and you move all the way across the spectrum on the far left side, and I don't mean that politically, I just mean on a spectrum if we're looking from right to left. On the other side of the spectrum would be the couple who very amicably sits down, and I call it, and I think other people refer to it this way, I didn't coin the phrase, a kitchen table divorce. And they agree on things, they know that they need to move on, they come up with an agreement, they write it up, and they move on. And maybe they hire an attorney to draft their documents or help them go through the court process, because we don't have any process other than a petition, a response, a decree, etc. But from one spectrum over here, sitting at the kitchen table working out an agreement, all the way to this other side where you have, you know, the higher-powered attorneys and business evaluators and custody evaluators and all of those people involved. Between those two are a couple of other alternatives, and that's why it's called alternative dispute resolution, because it's an alternative to a litigation model. And those alternatives include things like mediation, arbitration, collaborative divorce, cooperative divorce, negotiated settlements, and anything in between. So anything that's keeping you out of court but is not exactly a do-it-yourself, those are the alternative to the dispute.
So who are the parties involved in the collaborative and cooperative divorce model?
Let me first say that a collaborative model and a cooperative model are very similar, except that a collaborative divorce generally, and as far as when I'm speaking of a collaborative divorce, I'm talking about a divorce that's happening in a full team model, which is set forth in the protocols of our Collaborative Divorce Professionals of Arizona. And that's the practice group that I belong to and that is our professional organization here in Maricopa County. We fall under the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals, which is an international group. And in our practice group, we have adopted a quote-unquote full team model. And that means that there are the two parties, obviously. There is an attorney for each party. There's a communication coach for each party, and that person is a mental health professional. And then there is a neutral who is a financial expert. They're usually a certified divorce financial planner. And then there's a neutral who's appointed for the children, and that's the child specialist. And their job is to give the children in the divorce a voice at the table. and to provide some input and feedback for the parents as to what might be the most developmentally appropriate parenting plan. So when you have
that's very different from the traditional model, correct?
Absolutely. It's very, very different from the traditional model. And one of the ways that it's different from some other dispute resolution mechanisms is that it's also intended, at least to some extent, to be a transformative model. In mediation, we talk about evaluative models versus transformative models. Evaluative models of mediation mean, as your mediator, I'm going to tell you what your case is worth, what I think you should be doing, and I'm going to propose some solutions for you. So it's sort of a hybrid. Some people don't think of that as mediation at all. They think of it as more of a mediation / arbitration, because you are giving direction to the parties, and you're giving them pretty specific feedback as to what you think their case or their claim is worth. On the other end of the spectrum is the transformative model, where the mediator acts as a facilitator to allow the parties, no matter what the context of the dispute, to allow the parties to transform or resolve the dispute on their own and to come to their own conclusion. In the collaborative divorce model, we're really leaning much more toward that transformative model. One colleague of mine has stated that collaborative divorce really can be thought of as team mediation. And I think that's a good way for people to think about it, because everybody in the room is on the same team, and we're working towards helping this couple come up with a resolution that works for them, that's custom fit for them. You know, if you go to court, you're going to have more or less a one-size-fits-all resolution. The judge is required to follow the statute and will apply the case law, and will do all of that in a very limited amount of time because of the overload on the docket. In a collaborative divorce, it's very much like going to a tailor and having something made for you. It's custom fit for your family. So it's a very different paradigm.
Speak to it a little bit about the privacy issue as well, and who would be a good candidate for this.
You know, I love that question, because I think there's a huge information gap out there in the world. You know, unfortunately, we have a lot of television input into our beliefs around the law in general, and certainly around family law and how divorce will happen. What the TV shows fail to tell you is, first of all, how much it will cost, but second of all, the fact that your life will become a public record. And because of the way our rules and laws are structured, particularly in Arizona, I think we have a very liberal disclosure rule here in Arizona, and that's compliments of Justice Blackett, who was on our Supreme Court, and he felt that every party to every action should disclose everything that's relevant. And I agree with that. And I think that's a very fair way of going about it. Unfortunately, what's not fair, in most cases, I would say almost every case that you have a litigated divorce, anything that one party brings, either in a motion, in their pleadings, or as an exhibit to the court, becomes a public record. So if you are a business owner, and this is my best example of the person who should never go to court is any business owner. And the reason for that is because if your spouse wants to, for example, talk about the value of your business, they'll have a business valuation done. The business valuation will look at your tax return, your business tax returns, your bank accounts, your business credit card statements, your financial statements, your balance sheet, profit and loss, all of those things. And if you have a very competitive business, that type of information is extremely sensitive. That's not something you want your competitors to know. And yet, if you're in a divorce situation, your spouse can, and legitimately so, can bring all of that information to the court as an exhibit. It becomes public record. So you or I, Diane, can walk right down to the courthouse, pull the file from the court records and photocopy all of those tax returns, those credit card slips, all of those things.
And people do it. And the court won't seal it after it's already been made public knowledge. So when you do a cooperative or collaborative divorce, you don't have to file all that private, highly sensitive information. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And I think it's something that people don't even realize. Arizona, by the way, is we're always tied for first place. Maybe today we're in second place for identity theft. And the court has tried to implement some measures to overcome that. But the reality is that every single day in our court, documents are filed that have sensitive data, whether it's a bank statement, a credit card statement, anything like that. Any person can go and retrieve that record and use that information to steal your identity. That's an extreme case. I have actually had that happen to a couple of my clients where their spouse filed documents that contained their Social Security number. They had their identity stolen by people who literally sit at the courthouse and make copies of stuff all day long. That's extreme, but let's just back down off of that a little bit, and your disgruntled employee goes and sits in the back of the courtroom and listens to every word. And then the next thing you know, all of your financial data is public record. They've made photocopies. They've taken it to a competitor. Maybe they've even sold it to your competitor. Or perhaps it's your competitor sitting in the courtroom or making the photocopies of your financial statements and your business valuation. That person can now use very targeted information against you and against your business. And while it's an unintended side effect, it is a very real effect of a business person going to trial over a divorce, and it can be avoided.
So now we see that it's good for business owners. It's good for privacy, keeping your financial and sensitive information private and out of the public's access. And also we've heard that it's very good for the children because they're allowed a specialist and a voice within this conflict.
Absolutely. And I guess I should put a little more emphasis on the kids because one of the things that happens very often in a litigated divorce is that there's a custody evaluation. And I can't think of anything that could be, well, I can think of some things, but I can't think of anything in the legal context as to what attorneys are involved in that could be more harmful. And if you can imagine as a small child being taken to a psychiatrist or psychologist's office, usually it's a psychiatrist, taken to their office, tested, observed, asked questions, and first time with dad, second time with mom, third time with mom and dad, fourth time with your sister or brother, fifth time by yourself, asked to play with certain toys and answer questions. I can't think of anything more disturbing. It's unnatural for the child, certainly, and it tends to bring out the worst in parents. Their inclination, their natural inclination, is to try to sway the child to say all the right things about them and all the wrong things about the other parent. So it really is, it can be, and I think it almost always is, a very harmful situation for children. When you have a child specialist involved, it's a much more low-key process, and their job is to give the child a voice, not to evaluate the child. It's a very different mindset.
So the child's not being scrutinized, the child is being supported.
Exactly. And whatever is the best interest of the child specialist will then bring to the parents and provide that information and that input to them so that they can then craft a parenting plan that addresses the needs of the child versus their own needs or their own sort of selfish interests.
Or based on what the law says or what the judge decides.
Right. It will be what is particular to their child. Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all remedy. It's custom-tailored to that child in this family at this time. Very different from what the court might do.
Now, this sounds like it could be very, very, very expensive since there's so many people. Can you talk to us about the cost and if there's any savings to doing it this way, or is it more expensive?
Well, if we look again at our continuum, it's obviously more expensive than our kitchen table divorce. Because at the kitchen table, there's no professionals, or maybe there's one attorney who's drafting documents for both people. And if you move up the spectrum to litigation, I would say that the average is $100,000, $50,000 per person. And that's if you don't have a business entity that's being valued, because that would be a separate cost. And that's if you don't have a custody evaluation. If you have two people who are litigating and there's a business valuation for a moderately sized, a small business that the two people own, maybe under $5 million business, it's going to run somewhere between $10,000 to $15,000 for the business valuation. And then for the custody evaluation, if you have, let's say, two children, and there's no truly egregious circumstances, and you don't have a ton of witnesses, again, you're going to be looking at about $7,500. So when you add all that together, you're in the $125,000 range for that divorce. I would say that a collaborative divorce will come in significantly less than that, obviously. And if I had to guess, and sort of average my own experience with collaborative divorces, let me just think. There would be, I would guess that you'd be in the $20,000 to $30,000 range.
That's a huge savings, and there's a lot more support and a lot more that you get a lot more for your money in this situation that it's going to cost money anyways, so wouldn't you rather do the humane and supportive techniques, or would you rather do the litigation?
Absolutely.
That's what I would ask.
Oh, sure. And, I think everybody probably remembers that ad, you can pay me now or you can pay me later.
Yeah.
I think it was some car-related item. And I think that really applies to the collaborative divorce. You can pay me now a much less amount than you would pay for litigation, or you can pay me later, because, Diane, what so many people don't realize is once you have engaged in a litigated divorce, the likelihood is that you're going to be back in court again and again. And the reason for that is because you've never really addressed the core issues. You've never really resolved what the problem was to begin with. And so what we see is the post-decree litigation, and whether that's adjusting child support, spousal maintenance, parenting time, custody, or, even to the point of parents litigating over a few words in their parenting plan as to whether or not I get to pick Johnny up at 5 p.m. on Christmas Eve or 4 p.m. on Christmas Eve. Which is it? Or do I pick Johnny up on Wednesday, or do I pick him up on Thursday? And parents, very often, because they have never resolved the issues, the real issues between them, and they haven't learned how to communicate as co-parents, will end up back in court over and over and over. And that brings with it a cost that I don't even think we can estimate.
I agree.
Not just financially, but emotionally.
Absolutely, and that's so much higher. So who would this not work for? I mean, it sounds like you have to both be open to it. And is there someone that this would not work for?
When you say you both have to be open to it, in almost every situation that I encounter, with a few exceptions of the people who really are evolved and they're like-minded and they agree that this is not working out, in almost every other situation, you have one person who's sort of initiating that divorce and the other person who's a reluctant participant. And what we try to help with as a team is bringing the reluctant participant up to, along the continuum, bringing them up to speed so that they can feel and recognize and see for themselves the real value of participating. So it works for almost every couple as long as everybody's healthy. So the people that it really doesn't work for are people who have significant substance abuse problems. And that's true for any sort of alternative dispute resolution. It's very, very difficult to engage in alternative dispute resolution with a person who is not sober, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The other type of person that this method really is not appropriate for is someone who has significant mental illness to the point that it interferes with their ability to engage in meaningful discourse around the issues of their divorce. So if you have someone, for example, who is suffering from depression, they might be perfectly fine to engage in a collaborative process, and in fact, they might do best in that environment. However, if you have someone who has, for example, a borderline personality disorder, and they're having some either paranoia or they have severe narcissistic tendencies, those parties might not do as well in a collaborative arena because they may use it to their advantage.
Yes. Well, when there's a high conflict and the divorce is high conflict, you and I talked about a Penn State study that showed the connection between conflict and the conflict with divorce and divorce rate and crime rate. Can you tell us about that?
I'm going to tell you a little bit about it.
I'm
not the authority because the authority is Dr. Paul Amato, and he is the professor of sociology and demography. I don't even know how to say that word. Demographics and head of the sociology department at Penn State University. He addressed the Association for Family and Conciliation Courts Arizona chapter about 3 years ago, and he is a fascinating person to listen to. Very well versed in this type of information, family dynamics, and the result of divorce. And he had done a longitudinal study on the consequences of divorce on children. And the real problem is that divorce increases the risk of a multitude of problems for children, particularly the high conflict divorces. And the things that are impacted are obviously academic success, also relationship success long-term for those children, even into their adulthood, feelings of alienation and lack of self-worth. There's a high incidence of mental illness, but particularly depression. And there's also an incidental correlation to crime rate. And so one of his studies was in the Chicago area, and he tracked the divorce rate in two neighborhoods and watched the crime rates in both of those neighborhoods, and they tracked almost exactly. So, and it wasn't just juvenile offenses, although those were the majority of them. There were also some more serious crimes that went along with this divorce rate. So it's a pretty significant impact if you're going to have a high conflict divorce. And it doesn't just impact your family, it impacts our families as well. Because
yeah,
we might be the victims.
Absolutely.
Right, we might be the victims of those crimes. So what Dr. Amato wanted to see from this study is what's the impact. He found the impact and then he asked the question, how can we resolve that? We don't want to be creating a lot of little criminals out there just because we're having a bad divorce. So what he came up with are a few factors that improve a child's long-term well-being post-divorce. One thing that parents can do is to have authoritative parenting from both parents. So you have warmth, love, caring, support, and rules. That was very important because what sometimes happens, very often actually happens in a divorce, is that one parent becomes the Disneyland parent and the other parent becomes the punisher. So we have the person who's always enforcing homework and the house rules and so on, and the other parent who says, you know, let's just have fun and forget about the homework and forget about the curfew. And that sets up some problems. So authoritative parenting from both parents, a cooperative co-parenting relationship between the parents, very important factor that the parents are able to get along and communicate and truly be parents on the same page, co-parenting the child. They also have to maintain the child's standard of living. So what that often means is that there needs to be spousal support one way or the other, and there needs to be appropriate child support. Because if one parent is consistently impoverished and the other parent is living high on the hog, it again creates this disparity that children have a hard time with. Another factor that he saw was that was very important was residential stability. So that one or both parents remain either in the residence or close by. And what he said in the presentation that I attended was that when you see this residential stability break down, you automatically see children have higher problems academically and they lose their social ties, which may be a really important support group for the child as they're going through the divorce. And then finally, he wanted to see or recommended to see stronger community resources, whether that's through your religious affiliation or through school programs, park programs, and so on, but just to have those community resources there so that kids aren't abandoned. And I don't mean literally abandoned, but so that their needs are not abandoned. So those are some of the things that Dr. Amato feels are really important. And of course, you know, those of us who do collaborative divorce and other alternative dispute resolution, you know, latched onto this and said, here it is. Here he's done the research that proves our point, which is if we can have less conflict in these divorces, we will have healthier children. And when we have healthier children, the crime rate goes down, academic scores go up, and the whole family system survives. If we don't have these sort of supports in place, if we have the high conflict divorce, then we see crime rates going up, mental illness going up, drug abuse going up, teen pregnancy going up. It's a cascading effect.
It's all tied together.
Absolutely. It's a system, a family system.
Now, Pamela, is alternative dispute resolution and collaborative divorce available all over the U.S. or internationally? Or how can people find out about this?
Well, collaborative divorce is really an international movement, and Arizona has practitioners in Flagstaff, in Maricopa County, and in southern Arizona, primarily in Pima County. The International Academy of Collaborative Professionals has a directory on their website, and I'm going to give you that. Their website is www.collaborativepractice.com. And there you can find practitioners as far away as Australia, Canada, Europe, Ireland, all over the place. So it really is a burgeoning international movement.
And can you share with us your information, your website, and your phone number, please?
Sure, absolutely. My website is www.donisonlaw.com. That's DonisonLaw.com. And there's also our Collaborative Divorce Professionals of Arizona. And I'm just going to look that up right now because I always get a couple of those letters incorrect when I give that website. So I want to look that up for you. And again, that's our local Maricopa County practice group. And that group, that website is collaborativedivorcearizona.com.
AZ spelled out? Or not AZ, but Arizona spelled out?
Yeah, it's Arizona spelled out. Collaborativedivorcearizona.com. And again, there's a directory there. There's information about collaborative divorce. There's a list of our attorneys, divorce coaches, child specialists, and financial professionals. There's also a list of resources. And I think there's plenty of information there for people to get started in understanding collaborative divorce. Also, the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals has a lot of articles online to read about collaborative divorce.
Why does it seem like this has been sort of a secret? It sounds like there's so many websites and so many organizations, but it's kind of been kept in the dark a little bit. Would you agree with that, or have I just been missing the boat?
No, I think you're right, and I have a couple of theories. One theory I have, and this is not going to be popular, and I you know, may get some hate mail on this. One theory I have is that it's not all that profitable for attorneys to publicize this method of divorce because they're not going to make quite as much money off of those clients. So, you know, if they're not bickering, you're not billing.
Oh, that's a great one.
So that's one theory. That's not going to be very popular with my colleagues, but I kind of believe that's part of it, that attorneys maybe don't want everybody to really know about this. I think another part of it is that just as a society, we're just sort of coming up to an acceptance of family system dynamics, of understanding how all of the parts interplay, that we are holistic. Divorce is not just a legal battle. It's legal, financial, emotional, and physical, and spiritual, I might add. So I think we're just as a society coming to a realization and an acceptance of that, and I'll tell you that it's interesting that one of my trainers for my collaborative divorce training, and she's internationally known as a trainer. Her name's Janice Pritchard, and she's from Alberta, Canada. And her experience is very telling because in so many ways, our Canadian neighbors are far more advanced than we are. And in her community, she was the top litigator. And she found collaborative divorce, which came about in the early 80s. Some people up in Minnesota and Wisconsin developed the model. She came across it. She adopted it. And very quickly in her community, she spread the word. And now in that community in Alberta where she lives, they really don't have litigated divorces at all. It doesn't exist. So I think that, you know, we're lagging a little bit behind, but certainly that's the direction we'd like to go.
Well, Pamela, why would you as an attorney want to do it this way? I mean, if it's not as profitable and, you know, have you experienced both sides? Have you been litigator
Absolutely.
And now a collaborative supporter? I mean, tell me a little bit about you and why you would want to do it this way.
Well, Diane, that's a really good question, and I hope it would inspire some of my colleagues, but I did litigate divorces for longer than I wanted to, actually, and I'll tell you the story that brought me to collaborative divorce and actually spurred me to open my own practice and to practice in this way, and I practice alternative dispute resolution almost exclusively. Whether it's collaborative divorce, arbitration, which is like a private trial, or mediation, even negotiated settlement, my goal is to keep people out of court. And the reason for that is because I was working for another firm here in town in Phoenix, and I was litigating divorces, you know, left, right, and center, one after another, juggling, you know, 35 to 50 cases at a time. And at one point in early 2005, for whatever reason, I had sort of a perfect storm. I had five high-conflict cases. Now, one high-conflict case will, you know, put you over the edge, but five at a time was really difficult and very trying. And I was constantly filing motions, going to hearings over really what I think most ordinary people would consider to be petty things. And at one point, my assistant got a phone call from a pediatrician in North Scottsdale asking for an appointment. And she wanted to see me and my client. I represented dad and the opposing counsel and mom. She wanted all four of us in her office on a certain day, and that had never occurred. I'd never heard of such a thing, and I didn't know why she wanted to see us, and she wouldn't reveal the purpose. She just said, be there. I'm calling a meeting. And incidentally, you know, as a sidebar to this, there were three children that were involved in this divorce, and They were little stair steps, and they were just adorable little boys. And the youngest was about 18 months old, I'm sorry. His name was Jackson, and Jackson had asthma. And over a period of about 4 months, Jackson had been hospitalized approximately 6 times. And he was having severe asthma attacks consistently, and they just couldn't seem to get it managed. So we go to the pediatrician's office, and she, an adorable woman, very diminutive but authoritative, and she sat down and she said, this child has been hospitalized 6 times, and I'll tell you that each of you are to blame, because he is the weakest link in this family. And every time you write a letter, and every time, and she's looking at me and the other attorney, and every time you file a motion, and every time you have a hearing, Jackson goes to the hospital. And the reason is that he is absorbing the stress and the pain of the entire family. He's the weakest link. And then she looked at us, and she pointed at each of us in turn. She said, so you stop it right now. And she said, if you don't stop it, I will refuse to treat these children because I won't be a party to the abuse.
Oh, my God.
And that, I have goosebumps just telling you that story, because it was very emotional for me. I couldn't even believe the words coming out of her mouth, and yet I knew that it was true. I knew it was true.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. Spurred you to start your own practice and do it this way then?
It was my aha moment. It's when I knew that I could no longer be a participant, because literally I was participating in harming a child. So I couldn't sleep with that.
And I'm very grateful, and I'm sure that many others are very grateful for you doing that and stepping up and doing the right thing. And I have a question from Mary in Massachusetts. She says, custody fights are certainly the worst part of any divorce. Do you have any advice for grandparents that want to help soften the load on the kids?
Well, obviously, to just be supportive and to be a safe haven. One of the things that grandparents, aunts and uncles, and any extended family members or friends can do is support both parents, no matter how counterintuitive that may seem. Because when a child overhears or is told directly, your mommy or your daddy, you know, is a jerk or a bad person, or how dare he do, or how dare she, etc., the child internalizes that, and they really take that on as their own burden. And so when there's a horrible custody or other type of, you know, even if it's a parenting time battle going on, grandparents can be supportive by encouraging the children and letting them know, no matter what else happens with mommy and daddy, they love you, and we love you, and we're here for you. And, you know, at the end of the day, mommy's not a bad person and daddy's not a bad person. They just disagree. I think it really helps for children to hear that from multiple sources, because what they may be hearing at home is something completely different.
That's so true. And, you know, if it just doesn't work out between mom and dad, you know, you're still loved and important, and I think that's huge. And, you know, on your website, you have a link on the Achieve main page and from my site, too, with your website. Link to your website, and there is a lot of frequently asked questions on there, and that is really a great resource. But can you just spend a few minutes, we got about 5 minutes left, talking about some of the myths and the myth busters that you have to share with your clients when you first meet them?
Yeah, you know, again, it's back to the television mentality where people see things on television, or they hear it at the hair salon, or their neighbor, you know, tells them about their divorce, or their friend, their sister, their mom, their dad, whomever. One of the biggest myths I hear is that children get to decide where they live after a certain age. And sometimes the age is 12 or 14 or 15 or 16. There's this magical number that people believe at a certain age a child is entitled to to choose their own home. And that's just not accurate, at least not in Arizona. And I've actually been in court and had a judge tell a parent, absolutely, your child can decide where they live when they're 18.
and that's
the court's perspective. So there is no magic time that a child gets to choose where they live. Now, that being said, their input does become more relevant as they get older. But it's still up to the court and it's still up to the parents. So that's one of the big ones. Another big myth is that spousal maintenance is based on a variety of factors. I mean, you can make up whatever scenario you want, and I've probably heard it. The reality is that under Arizona statutes, we have about 19 or 20 factors that are looked at in totality for awarding spousal maintenance. And it's actually a two-part test. So the first part is, are you eligible at all? And then the second part is, if you are eligible, what are some of the other factors that would play into an award of spousal maintenance? I've had people ask me, well, is it true that my spouse will get half my income? Or is it true that because we were married for, you know, more than 5 years that I get, you know, 25% of his income? Those things just aren't true. And I don't know where they come from, but there's some factory out there that's manufacturing myths.
Sure. And now, since you are part of a couple groups and international associations and all, would you feel comfortable referring people in other parts of the country? Because I know, you know, there's a few of your colleagues here in this area, but if someone, say, from somewhere else wanted a referral, would you feel comfortable doing that, or do you just recommend they go to the website?
Well, if they're looking, I do know some colleagues in other parts of the country. I'm familiar with them either through committee work that I've done or through trainings and so on. So there's always the chance that I will actually know a person in the community that the client is looking in. But otherwise, I would say go to the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals website and put in your community and find out if there's someone practicing there in collaborative divorce. And if not, then we can help you find someone.
And can you share again your contact information, your website, and then also I just have one other question. Do you offer like a consultation and then see if this is an option, or do people need to sign a retainer like a lot of other type of professionals do, or how does that work?
That's sort of a two-part question. Do we offer a consult? Yes, we do. Is it free? No, it is not. There are a variety of reasons for that. But our initial consultation is at a discounted rate. And at that time, it's really about me getting a little bit of information and then educating the potential client about their options and what those options cost, and letting them have some time to think about it. In Arizona, under our State Bar of Arizona rules, we are required in every scenario that we represent a client or that we provide ongoing services to have a written fee agreement. And in family law, that almost always means there will also be a retainer deposit required. So under our State Bar rules, we have to have something in writing, and under our sort of our community norms for family law, almost every attorney will require a retainer, and I'm one of them. Now, the other part of that regarding consults, when we meet with someone and they're considering a collaborative divorce, we also want them to meet with the other members of the team before we make a decision to go forward and to retain. So it's a multi-step process. Because the person who's divorcing, or either one or both of them, need to feel very comfortable with the entire team.
Sure. That makes sense. And again, can you share your website with us
Sure.
and your phone number?
Absolutely. My phone number, I'm in Scottsdale, and my phone number is 480-951-6599. And my website is www.donisonlaw.com. Again, my name is Pamela Donison. You can Google me and probably find out more about me than I want to know. And we're here during business hours, you know, Monday through Friday. If I'm not available, of course, you can always speak to my case manager, Nate Stone, who's very well accomplished, and he's able to answer a lot of questions as well.
I really want to thank you, Pamela. It's been really great chatting with you, and thank you for sharing this great information. And
thank you for the opportunity, Diane. I really enjoyed talking to you. And, of course, you know, it's sort of a joke, but, you know, what lawyer doesn't like to talk?
Well, I've really enjoyed this one. I must say this has been the only one I've enjoyed. Well, okay, not the only one, but anyways, I have my own things around that. But anyways,
absolutely.
Your information is very valuable, and you're really, really appreciated. Thank you again.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you.